Before we get into the deep stuff, let's just talk, let's give some basics or some things I want to do inquire from the others. Walk me through the Santa Fe Institute. What was it about the time of the math? And this was in the late 90s. So they're not going to hear me on this part, right? We're going to do it both ways?
It will not be on the video, but we do have you recorded.
Fine. Remember, when you're answering the on these questions, I'm not in the shot, and they're never going to hear my voice. So a little bit, you got to repeat the... In your answer, you got to repeat what my question was.
Oh, love it. Okay.
Santa Fe Institute. Why, when you're at the top of your game on Wall Street, do you decide to finance, which was at the time, or endow, or become the donor or sponsor, however you want to say it, for what was considered the most cutting-edge group of mathematicians in the world? Action.
So Santa Fe Institute in the late 80s, early 90s, I was interested, I was on the board of Rockefeller. So that starts, Rockefeller it's University, formed by John D. Rockefeller to sort of give back to the community, it's east side of Manhattan, except it was old. It was sort of old-fashioned. They were talking about medicine, and medicine by itself was, again, subject to the ideas of science. They were trying to use science to find cures for disease. And I said, no, we need to do something different. We need to start interdisciplinary work. In most...
How did a schmuck like you get on the board of Rockefeller? What year was that?
I don't remember. Late, I think 89 or 91.
So that's one of the most prestigious research places in the world, correct?
Yes.
Okay, how did a guy like you get on the board of Rockefeller? A blue blood, internationally known, hard research... Nobel Prize winners all over the place. How do they pick a guy like you, a trader from, or basically some guy from Bear Stearns?
Good question. So I was asked to be on the board of Rockefeller. And I think I was on the board of Rockefeller. There was a money manager who said, Rockefeller needs someone with financial expertise because the university is growing. And there's lots of new things. You have to, again, we go back to the original discussion the last time. Up until the mid-80s, or sort of early mid-70s, the most important thing was your name. If you were Rockefeller, you already were considered to be brilliant. If you were a head of General Motors, it was your reputation. It was who you knew, who your family was. What was your character? And then in the mid-70s, basically, if you remember, you probably had a calculator. It was very advanced in those days to have a Texas Instrument calculator where it could, by putting in the numbers, it would multiply for you to do square roots. And that was the first, and everyone who had a calculator was already advanced on Wall Street. A simple calculator, almost like your accountant. The most important parts of business were really now going to calculations. So it's not only mathematics, but it's things that could be calculated. Reputation couldn't be calculated. I could give you, are you a 10 on a reputation scale, an 8? What does it mean to have a measurement of your reputation? We'll get to that later. But people, places like Rockefeller needed someone to say, look, we are entering a different world where numbers and the numbers of companies, portfolio management was going to be balanced. It was going to be statistical. Jeffrey, could you come on the board? Potentially sit on the finance committee. Nancy Kissinger and a bunch of other people. And David Rockefeller and I got along very well. He was this unbelievable human being. Respectful to everyone. He introduced his driver as his colleague, not his driver. He would never say, this is my driver. He said, it's my colleague. And David started to explain to me world politics. So David would say, Jeffrey, money is going to be sort of the most important things. People don't understand money. You seem to have this knack for money. I said to David, tell me about your life. What was the worst and the best part of your life? So David said, when I grew up, everyone knew I was a Rockefeller. They didn't know that my father told me he would not leave me a dime. No money. But every time we went out to eat, me and my five friends in school, they would leave me the bill. They would expect me to pick up the check because I was a Rockefeller. And he said, I was chairman of Chase Bank. And he said, I remember like it was yesterday, one of the headlines in Time magazine said, David, please fire yourself. So he thought that there was a world that existed in that would be a combination of both politics and business and leadership. What do I mean? He formed something called the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission is some spooky stuff. People said it was some of the people that the Illuminati, there's some mystery about it, people that ran the world. It was politicians, but David said most countries, the politicians get elected for 4 years or 8 years, separate from the royal families in England or in the Middle East. Someone's there for 4 years and then they're not there anymore. The most important people to have stability and consistency would be businessmen. So he formed this trilateral commission of businessmen and politicians from three major continents. So it was the North Americans, the Europeans, and the Asians. So he said to me, would you like to be on the Trilateral Commission? Now, I was 30 years old, 32 years old. I said, great. And he said, well, you have to fill out this application so they have your bio. And I looked at the list of people, and it was Bill Clinton, former president of the United States, Paul Volcker, every great leader in America, the Asians, the Japanese, and with a very long description of their history. And they asked me to fill in what I would like to have written, and I wrote Jeffrey Epstein, comma, just a good kid, which I thought was funny. Nobody else did. So in answer to your question, at that time I recognized around the world that monies and currencies were not really well understood. But again, it was only numbers. So numbers, and I'll get to the fact that it was bad thinking. Numbers are very good.
Are most people that you meet, even on a trilateral commission, when you meet most people, do you find most leaders financially illiterate? Economically illiterate.
Most political leaders don't come out of a background of finance. Most political leaders come out of a background of being popular. So in some of the countries, except in the African countries, for example, they might have been a military person. They were a general. In some of the African countries, they might have been a disc jockey. Or in our country, they would have been an actor. The knowledge of money isn't, they don't have an expertise, they have no degrees in finance. They really, and this is one of the major problems, their expertise, if they have any financial knowledge, is of their own checking account or bank account and filling in their own taxes. So many world leaders who don't really have a financial underpinning make fundamental errors when it comes to money on a country or institutional level. Let me give you an example. If you, Mr. Bannon, if I said your assets increased last year, you'd say, that sounds pretty good. And I'd say, what does that mean to you? You'd say, well, I have more money. I guess I'm wealthier. I'd say, yes. And if your debt increased, would you feel wealthier or poorer? You'd say, well, I don't want to have increased debt. I don't like the idea of that sound, increased debt. Now, that and world leaders understand when their assets go up, they feel better. However, institutions like banks, things that people don't really understand are financial underpinnings of banks. When I say your bank, Mr. Bannon, you have the Bannon Bank, you doubled your assets. Sounds good, but what does it really mean? It means people owe you more money. You don't have any money, more money. What? Yeah. A bank's assets are how much it is owed by other people. That's crazy. So if the bank goes from a $2 billion of assets to $10 billion, it means people owe it an additional $8 billion, but their assets have gone up. So the terminology of assets and liabilities is different for banks. It's not natural. And what most people, and you ask questions about world leaders, as many people, I think your old boss Mercer understood, there's a fundamental part of money which is called fractionalized banking. And fractionalized banking is something that finance people understand, and the people on the street, and when I say people on the street, that's where I was when I started on Wall Street, would find it impossible to believe. Impossible. Why? Bannon Bank, I give you $1, just one single dollar. In our system of banking, I would say, okay, Steve, I gave you a dollar. How much could you lend out to your friends? And your natural reaction would be probably something less than a dollar because I want to keep something in my pocket. The way our system works is if you as a bank are holding my dollar, you can lend out an additional $8 or $9. No, it's impossible. I only have a dollar, Jeffrey. We have something called fractionalized reserves. Which is if you have one, you can lend out nine. That's the way our system works. And so not only do world leaders not understand banking, but the man on the street, my father who worked in the park department, it would be beyond his imagination that people could lend out more money than they actually had in their pocket. Next question.
Well, how did this, in understanding that, when you get on something like the Trilateral Commission, you're on the board at Rockefeller, which is the most advanced research. You get brought into the Trilateral, which is the elite of the elite. How, since you're only at that time
30-something years old.
8 years from teaching at Dalton, right?
You're Dalton. Ten years.
Ten years teaching at Dalton.
Yes.
Walk us through. I mean, put us in the room. Walk me through exactly what it felt like. What it felt like being on the board at Rockefeller. We got these Nobel laureates, and you're sitting there making decisions, and you start to meet these people at Rockefeller. Now you start to meet these people at the Trilateral Commission. What did it feel like?
That's a great question. So what did it feel
That's
like?
That's what I'm in the business of asking. Yeah.
What did it feel like meeting some of these people like Kissinger or Rockefeller? And those are two extraordinary people. But in general, I think the question, the people on Wall Street, I tell the story, one of the first days when I was in Wall Street, someone said to me, would you like to buy ATV? And I was looking in the brochure, and I couldn't figure out what stock had a symbol of ATV. And when I finally said, well, I can't find it, and they said, what's the matter with you? Do you want to buy ATV? Which is, he was selling hot televisions, stolen televisions from the floor of the American Stock Exchange, referred to in common parlance as the televisions fell off the truck. So I knew what that phrase meant from Coney Island. But what I found was most people, be it in business, in normal life, or in the world leaders, don't really understand money. It is something they think about. They have a sense of what it is. They certainly want more of it. But they also make statements like, we want more money, but we don't want more debt, which just shows a misunderstanding of what money at its core really is. So they want to make it, they want to save it, but to understand it intimately is not a normal character.
At the first Trilateral or something?
Yeah, good.
Just give me approximate. You joined the Trilateral Commission.
I think it might be nine.
And we'll be able to show we'll pull down the chart of where your name was, but just give me roughly when it was.
I think it could be 90. I don't remember. Okay.
Let's say early 90s.
Yes.
When you got on the Trilateral Commission and had the first, where was the, do you remember where the first meeting was?
It was in Tokyo.
In Tokyo. In what hotel?
I would like to say the Hilton, but it's probably not.
And it's a three-day
event. And
walk me through the whole thing.
Speeches.
It starts with a dinner. Just walk me through it.
It was boring.
You couldn't possibly think it was boring. It's bullshit.
It was boring.
Stars in your eyes.
No.
Did you fly over privately?
Yes, but it wasn't my plane.
So it didn't count?
No.
You fly over.
Yes.
And it was who were the first, like when you first met those leaders, you had to be wowed.
No.
You're 10 years out of Coney Island.
No, I'm not wowed by people of position. I'm wowed by people of great ideas. And I don't care if it's the bus driver. I don't care if it's the student I had who has teeth coming out.
Well, these guys have to have great ideas. They're the leaders of the three great continents of the world, North America, Europe, and Japan.
No, many of these world leaders become world leaders because they're popular and they were able to get votes or they were able to convince people to vote for them. I learned later. Many of them were just good at what they did in terms of politics. Remember, world leaders are politicians in general. They're not scientists. They're not intellectuals. They're not great thinkers. They're great politicians.
At the first Trilateral Commission meeting that you remember in Tokyo in sometime in the early 90s, do you remember what were the big issues of the day that they were talking about, and what did you think about it?
Yeah, in fact, it was funny because they were talking about inflation, and they were worried that what would happen, how do you control inflation? And I, as a mathematician, I didn't understand the concept. I don't understand the concept today. How's that possible? Well, when you talk about most things to do with money, money is meant to be local. It's U.S. dollars. Then I understand what it means. If inflation, it means my dollar today inflates, and it doesn't buy as much as it did a couple of years ago. The prices go up. I don't have. It seems that everything is great, but in fact, my dollar is shrinking in value.
If you, and you're the financial genius here. I'm just a lowly M&A guy.
Sure. If you let me finish the thought.
Go ahead.
So if you're in America, you can feel inflation. Your salary's gone up, but you don't can't buy the same car. In fact, it starts to feel weird because the value.
That's why I wanted to ask the question. Then this is my point.
Sure.
The people who live and breathe this, the central banks, have been haunted by the specter of inflation since the late 70s.
Yes.
First off, tell our audience, how did that happen? The two great financial events in the 20th century, I'm not going to get to the 21st, were the great inflation in Europe after World War I, the Great Depression, the hyperinflation in Germany that led to the rise of Hitler, and then this inflation in the mid-70s. Before you go over explaining inflation, why is this specter of inflation always the central thing in central bankers' minds?
Because it goes back to the first concept I said, the weird concept of fractionalized reserves. The system is not well understood. And most systems, in fact, are not well understood. We don't know how our digestive system...
Hold on, stop. This is impossible. This is impossible. The world banking system, the world currency system, the world monetary system,
yes,
has to be so well understood by the Greenspans of the world and the Bernankes of the world right? The currency traders, the guys making billion-dollar bets every day, the legendary guy on Wall Street in the late 90s, Solomon Brothers.
Lou Ranieri?
No, the guy that wrote the money.
Michael Lewis? Liar's Poker?
Yeah, Liar's Poker. Who's that about, that great trader?
Lou Ranieri.
No, the guy that ran the desk, yeah, that eventually ran the hedge fund that went long-term capital.
Ah, yes, I don't remember.
Who's the guy?
I want to say, I don't remember. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Lunar is big, but yes, those guys have to understand the system perfectly.
No, they don't understand the system. They understand the local part of the system. So, for example, why is not only inflation, most bankers are terrified if the public understood that the bank really doesn't have their money at any one time. It's one of the things during the Depression, there were runs on the bank. The reason the banks don't keep much money in the actual bank is they assume that not everyone's going to want their money on the same day. So it's not really the fear of inflation. The fear is a run on the bank. Everybody wants to take out something that doesn't really exist. Inflation is tied to interest rates. It's a more complicated example. But when your money doesn't buy the same amount of product this year that it did last year, if it buys less and less, like it happened, you use the term hyperinflation. There's certain countries that are not managed well, like in Africa at the current, a $100 billion bill, $100 billion bill in Zimbabwe is worth one American cent. That's the perfect example of hyperinflation. It goes up, it doubles every day. So people are afraid that their value in the system starts to break down. But so if I said to you, does your doctor understand your body system? You'd say, well, I hope so, because I want him to keep me healthy. But you could have a kidney infection. You could have a heart attack. You could have a broken knee. There's lots of pieces of this system. And in fact, when you ask the question, very few doctors understand your entire body. There's a specialist for your knee. There's a specialist for your polyneoidal cyst. There's a specialist for your head. And now we have specialists in different areas. So I'm going to get to your first question about Santa Fe Institute. The world economy and your body are both comprised of little systems interacting with each other and making one big system.
This is what's stunning for all the little guys out there, the populist movement, the little guys that haven't had a pay raise in 30 years. They think that these elites, you know, have everything. The guys in the room making the decisions, the party of Davos guys. You're sitting there, and you don't think many people today really understand the complexity and really all the moving pieces and how they interconnect to the world's financial system.
No, not only don't they understand the complexity, and that goes back to Santa Fe Institute was an attempt of trying to see if there was a way to mathematize, formularize, or algorithmically understand what the term complexity means. That goes back to the original question. Complex systems are complex by definition. But there's not necessarily, it's not one level of complexity. As we might say, well, our fingers are complex. The movements, the muscles of our hands. But it's not as complex as the blood system. Now I have a circulatory system. I have systems on top of systems. So that there's no one group of or person that really understands the way the body works. There's no one group that understands the way the financial systems work. You might understand U.S. bond market. Now, you've asked about the trader, long-term capital. That was a bond fund. Very small part of this very complex system. So the goal of the Santa Fe Institute was to see, is there a way to get in somehow understand how complex systems interact? Fast forward, Steve, to today, where Google and these other engine companies, the other tech companies, are trying to build artificial intelligence. The strangest thing that they found, one of the strangest things, is that the systems that they design, this artificial intelligence, which a lot of people have heard about, is they design a bunch of systems, they're called neural nets. Terms simply taken out of brain work, neurons in the brain, nets because they actually look like a net. They put in some inputs. The computers work, spit out an answer. Sounds normal to you. It's because you're thinking about that calculator you had in 1976 on your desk. When you ask the person who designed the system, how did it come to that answer? How did your neural net... Can you show me the calculations? They say, no, we don't know. We don't know how the thing we designed actually came up with that answer. That's pretty strange. They take the same neural net now, and they put it in front of a video game. No learning, nothing. They said to the computer, they say, sit in front of your video game and learn how to play. It seems the computer learns better than any human in history. Faster than any human in history, beats any human in history, but when you ask the designer how did it do it, no one knows. It just did it. So that's the first little touch of things that we already have gotten to a place where we don't understand it and we built it.
On Sunday afternoon, September 14th, 2008, where were you?
Sorry?
It was the night they put Lehman Brothers in bankruptcy in London.
I was in jail.
Seriously?
Yes.
So the financial crisis of 2008 happened when you were in jail?
Yes.
Oh, this is going to be so amazing. I take it you didn't have your Wall Street Journal dropped off to you in the morning, your Financial Times.
No.
How did you hear about because I want to,
I forgot about this, but yes.
I'm trying to get, this is going to be amazing. This is, let's go back and do that again. Sunday afternoon, because I want to find out about people, the geniuses understanding the complexity of the financial system. Because I think the best example we have is the financial crisis, the crash of 2008. Sunday afternoon, September 14th, I think it was, 2008, is when they were working feverishly in Midtown Manhattan at the Lehman Brothers offices and at various law firms around town, and with the Secretary of Treasury about, and the Federal Reserve, what they're going to do with Lehman. They decided they weren't going to save it. And so they prepared to put it into bankruptcy at the opening of the market in London the next day. How did you hear about what was going to happen to Lehman Brothers, and what did you immediately think when you heard that it was going to be put into bankruptcy?
I'm glad you asked that question. I was in solitary confinement September 14th. And again, some of the public stories about the wonderful time I had in jail and my work release, which didn't come till months after. I'd been there since June. In an 8x10 cell with a bed in the back, a 6-foot bed in the back, a chrome sink with a toilet attached to it, and a little piece of metal sticking out that was supposed to act as a table. Now, since I was in jail, there were no books. Why? There's no library. No library, but you're in jail. No, I was in jail, not prison. So in jail, I was in a place what's called the special housing unit, which is for the roughest, toughest, meanest people. They had put me there, they said, for my own protection. So I was in an 8x10 cell with a little slit in the door where they would serve my food on a tray about 9 inches by 4 inches. And then as soon as I finished eating, they would take the tray and close it down. And one of the guards said, "Do you understand there's Wall Street's crashing. I'm worried about my pension fund. What should I do?" And I said, "Sorry, Wall Street's crashing? What's happened?" And he said, "There's some crisis and some companies are going bankrupt." I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah, it's all over the papers. We're all terrified we're going to lose our life savings because we have either a 401k or our pension funds. We don't know anything about money. Mr. Epstein, can you tell us, like, what's going on? Am I going to be able to afford my children's education? Am I going to be bankrupt, like this company called Lehman Brothers? And there's another company in the front page today called Bear Stearns." "Oh, no," I said. "Why? Because that's the company I was a partner in. And in fact, that was a company I had a very large investment in." So, as a great story, I didn't have my Wall Street Journal, but in the early mornings, you're allowed to make 2 phone calls, collect. And when you pick up the phone, you can dial a number. And when the person picks up, they say, "You're getting a call from the Palm Beach County Jail. Will you accept reverse charges?" And the person either says yes, and the call goes through, or the person says no. The person I had called was Jimmy Kaine, the president of Bear Stearns. And I said, "Tell me what's going on." And so that my knowledge of the financial crisis happened with Jimmy, who was at the center of the storm, telling me about what Lehman had gone under, and they were trying to figure out a way, should they bail out Bear Stearns?
Did it strike you at the time of the mess you had made of your life to be in a situation that you're one of the greatest financial minds in the world, looked at by world leaders and asked their, your thinking by the most prominent and important people in the world, and here you are in solitary confinement. You got to make a collect call to somebody. Did it strike you at the time how all the threads of your life had come together and put you in a position, or you had put yourself in that position?
No.
So it never struck you when you had to make a collect, your one collect call, one of your two, 50% of your collect calls that day, you call the president or the head of the CEO of Bear Stearns. The biggest financial event in your life is taking place, of which one, every important person in the world would be seeking your opinion. Number two would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to apply your craft. Number three, it would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make money if you were smart, and obviously you're smart. You're telling me here, truthfully, that it never hit you at all of how you'd ended up in a place where you had to make a collect phone call from a jail cell that was 6x9 with a steel bed and your food being passed in through a slot.
The question you want to ask is, who was the other call to?
Okay. Who was the other call to?
The other call was to my friend at J.P. Morgan, who was then, I didn't know it at the time, trying to buy Bear Stearns. So at one point, I had two phones. It was difficult because they're afraid people are going to hang themselves with the phone cord. So they don't actually come together and they're pretty short. So I was actually going between two phones talking to Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan at the same time. So I found it amusing.
And it never struck you about how to end up in a situation like this?
No, that would be probably means I would be too self-aware.
You can't possibly expect me to believe this.
I know. I don't believe it.
You're telling me that during that day, you never had a moment. You sat there and go, what the fuck have I done with my life that I'm in a 6x9 jail cell when I should be on a trading desk or I should be in my $250 million, greatest townhouse in New York City taking calls from the king of Saudi Arabia, the president of China, the head of Russia, the president of the United States to save the world's population from a financial debacle. You honestly expect me to believe that never happened?
You're suggesting I was somewhat depressed, and how could this happen to me?
I'm not saying depressed. I'm saying a moment of awareness of how could I get myself into this situation.
No, I would just say how strange that this happens. Just, it's strange. I'm wearing a jumpsuit and flip-flops.
What color was the jumpsuit?
Brown.
Brown jumpsuit.
Yes.
I notice I don't see you in a lot of brown.
No.
Brown jumpsuit and flip-flops.
Flip-flops, yes.
With no access to books, no access to newspapers.
No access to anything.
You had lived on information.
Except my Almond Joy bars. I had extra Almond Joy bars.
Did you eat Almond Joy bars and things like that because you were afraid of what the cooks did to your food?
Yes.
Is that because that you were in for the crimes that you were in for?
No, it was just
because you're wealthy?
Yes.
How did you know that?
Well, people would constantly come, if I was passing by or have to go for my medical, people would either ask to borrow money or make some other types of comments about.
What were the comments?
It serves you fucking rich guys right that you're here next to me.
There was nothing about your crimes?
No.
So all this rumor you hear all the time about people in prison that commit the type of crimes you commit, that's you're saying in your personal thing is not true?
No.
It was all because you were rich?
Yes.
And it was all because they wanted to borrow money?
Or get advice. Yes.
Where they get advice to go long.
Yes,
you're telling me in solitary confinement they're interested in going long?
Yeah. They want to know
what does that say about human nature?
Well, what I think the people find, one of the reasons they wanted to keep me in solitary confinement was they're afraid that everybody would want to know which stocks to buy. But what happened was after this crisis, now it's on the front page of every newspaper.
I don't want to lose this day.
Sorry.
When you first heard that, was it Bear Stearns had been kicked into bankruptcy, 6 months before?
No, it's just the same time. This is part of the same deal.
Bear Stearns, they saved Bear Stearns and didn't save Lehman Brothers. That's right. It. 6 months before, they had bailed out Bear Stearns. But Bear Stearns was still a zombie.
A shell of its former self.
A former self. But they had, quote-unquote, saved it. They admit, why did they make the decision, in your mind, why did Hank Paulson and Bernanke, what's this concept of moral hazard? Explain to the audience what moral hazard is. And why did they save Bear Stearns 6 months before? And why did the smartest guys in the room decide not to save Lehman Brothers?
It's a good question. The real issue is I'd have to go back when you have these systems to the way your doctor responds to any type of emergency in your body. If they might decide to save your kidneys and let your gallbladder go because the gallbladder is less important to your overall system. If at that time, even it's not that long ago, the boogeyman was... When said, well, what really happened? Jeffrey, what really happened? What is this financial crisis? And, you know, some of the progressives and the right wing blame it on the banks. It was the bank's fault. And it's the fault of this very esoteric, unknown concept of derivatives. It was really the derivatives that caused this financial crisis because the derivatives got somehow out of control and like, in the Mickey Mouse,
and that was the way you started your road to a billionaire went right through derivatives.
Yes, but derivatives were not the cause. Derivatives were not the cause at all. It's like saying your hair was the cause of your heart attack because it was on top of your head.
So what was
the
cause?
There isn't. Let me say, there's no one specific cause. These are system collapses. So many times when they have to make your death certificate, when you say, well, what did he die from? They'll say heart failure. But if you say, what was the cause of his heart failure? Well, he had low blood pressure, his sugar was high, he was diabetic, he had all these other problems. But you say, no, we need a word on your death certificate. Did he die from brain damage? Did he die from heart failure? That's the financial crisis. People said, well, what caused it? They wrote, like on its death certificate, derivatives. But derivatives are not a fundamental cause of anything.
Was it Sunday or Monday? I take it was Monday morning when you made your two collect calls and you're talking to Bear Stearns on one hand and Morgan Stanley on the other.
JP Morgan.
That was Monday morning. Did you, yeah. Jeffrey, being one of the financial geniuses in the world, did you understand what Lehman Brothers is going into bankruptcy, the domino effect that by Thursday the financial system would be under such extremis that if it didn't have $1 trillion cash infusion in the United States, it might collapse? Did you know that at the time? Did you view that at the time?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah.
Why?
Again, I don't want to bore you or the audience with the idea of it's a medical procedure, but you had system failures. So you'd recognize that if I said to you, did you realize when your father was on the ground and he was clutching his chest and he couldn't breathe, it was a bad situation, he could die. That's how I saw it.
Did you immediately think about the commercial paper market? I mean, the mechanical triggers that actually had to... You had to blow through these circuit boards. Did you know the circuits? Did you understand the circuits? Or did you have a concept of the circuits that were going to get blown through?
Yes, but only because of an analogy to a body. And in fact, from my telephones against the wall with my little metal wires, because the next day I talked to another person in Washington about the issues of what I thought was happening, and I made the same discussion about the...
They were at the Treasury Department?
Yes.
So in a 6x9 cell in...
The phones were outside the cell.
In Palm Beach County, California?
West Palm Beach, Florida.
West Palm Beach, Florida.
This was your juice diet.
West Palm Beach, Florida. You're making a call to Washington, D.C. to talk to some deputy secretary
someone
in Treasury.
Someone in Treasury.
Right. Someone in Treasury.
Right.
And that does not... The night before you go to bed... It doesn't dawn on you at all. You never have a moment of self-reflection that how did I end up on this metal cot when I should be at the center of things?
No, I had a telephone. So I said, I can talk to, it makes no difference where I am. In fact, I'm still talking to the same person if I was at my home in Palm Beach. But I'm here in jail.
Your home in Palm Beach.
I can dial my own phone.
That's bullshit. No, but you can also make 1,000 phone calls. Here you got to make one, and he's got
to
take
the how much better that was. I had to decide who was the right person to call. That was unusual for me, because I would have called 20 people.
And what was this, what was the advice you gave him?
I said, you have a sick patient, and it's very much like a sick patient in the emergency room. You can't think about it like your car. People in normal walks of life think about money and things as a machine. And unfortunately, so if your car breaks, cars are always easy to fix. My jets, my cars, if it breaks, I know it can be fixed because it simply follows the same pattern. If this part breaks, you replace the part and the thing works again. People and the financial system are not machines. They can't be fixed the same way. You can't simply take out put some more juice into the commercial paper market, and that's like replacing the carburetor on the car. It's much more, I have a patient who can't breathe, has a stomach problem, can't see, looks bleeding at the same time. What do I do first? I have to think about it as a system. Where's the most logical place? What's the most dangerous place? If your heart stopped, we have to start your heart again. If in the equivalent to the money market, why do I have to start your heart again? I need to get your blood flowing. If your blood stops, you're dead. If liquidity, which is the equivalent of blood in the financial system, dries up.
Liquidity is basically cash, putting cash into the system.
Forget about what it is.
Okay.
Liquidity is liquidity. It allows the system, it's the blood of the system. You need to pump blood hard into the body of the economy to keep it flowing. And especially when you're worried about someone dying, you're not going to be worried about the niceties of, well, you got the shirt dirty and there was some damage. Pump in that blood, keep that heart pumping.
When you talked to the person in Treasury on Tuesday the 16th, did you get a feeling as you were sitting in your 6x9 jail cell in West Palm Beach, Florida, that they were on top of things?
No, you can't. It's impossible to be on top of things. There's no such thing. It's, again, the doctor watching the patient die, you hopefully have some confidence that he's seen it before. He recognizes that there are some steps he has to take first before he bandages the guy's finger or worries about what shoes he has on. So you hope that the people in charge, your doctors who are working on the emergency patient, have enough experience and, frankly, judgment to try to keep the patient alive.
Did you think that they had those things, patience and judgment?
They had pretty good judgment, and you needed a lot of luck, just like in the dead patient. You need to, hopefully you put that blood in and it's not too late. And you make some mistakes, but you have to know you're going to have to give it a shock.
In the run-up to the September crash of 2008,
yeah.
I guess you weren't occupied with finance. That whole summer, how long had you been in jail?
I went to jail June 30th.
So the entire summer.
Yes.
Before you went into jail, you were still very active in the financial markets.
Yes.
When I say active, you trade currencies every day, you trade stocks every day. When people,
I don't do anything.
Someone like you, or you give advice to people to trade stocks or trade currencies.
I don't trade every day. I think that's like Woody Allen said, it's you can't beat the bank. So I try to pick my spots. George Soros picked his spot when the pound collapsed. This would have been a great money making opportunity that passed me by when I was in jail, but that's not how I think.
In the run-up to that, in the spring of 2008, were you? That's when Bear Stearns got in problems, I think, in the spring of 2008, and they decided to bail it out. Did the Bear Stearns guys talk to you for advice at that time, in the big crisis in Bear Stearns?
No, but unbeknownst to most people, and it's easy to blame people for the financial crisis, like you'd blame someone for giving your father the drink before he had his heart attack. But what really happened, the real enemy of the finance system was Bill Clinton. And if you ask me what and who caused the financial crisis, I would tell you it was Bill Clinton.
Because of what Bob Rubin and he did to the financial, deregulate the financial system?
No. Because as of the last time we had our 60-minute interview, you talked to me about home ownership. and you asked me whether everyone should own a home. And I told you, no, it's too risky.
So the financial collapse of 2008 is because of hardworking African-Americans, Hispanics, and whites who wanted to have a piece, have a ownership stake in the society that all rests on their shoulders. They're the culprits.
No, not at all.
Okay, then
I didn't say they were the culprits. I was pretty clear it was Bill Clinton.
Okay.
Why was it Bill Clinton? Because Bill Clinton wanted to get votes from those people. And he sold them the idea that instead of renting in a house, and historically the values of houses have gone up, and he said, you guys in these local communities who haven't been able to afford a house before, I'm going to show you a way. I'm going to give you a way, because I'm sure I'll get your vote, that you can own a house because I want your vote. So what we're going to do is I'm going to let you buy a house, Mr. Bannon, when you really, you're right on the border, maybe, or not even on the border. Your credit is not good. Okay, let's be honest. And it's not my fault, it's not Bill Clinton's fault, but if whatever happens, at the moment your credit score or whatever it is, your credit's not good. Now, normally, you come to me and want to borrow money, I'm a bank, and I say, I'm sorry, Mr. Bannon, I can't lend you money because your credit score is not up to where it needs to be. Hopefully, if you work harder and clean up some of your problems, it will be. But no, what I say to you is, I'm going to figure out a way to lend you, not give you, I'm going to lend you money anyway, though you don't have a good credit score. And don't worry, I'm going to get rid of the term that you don't have bad credit. Bad credit sounds pejorative. You don't want to be a person.
Sounds judgmental.
Yeah, it sounds judgmental. So what we're going to do is we're going to call your credit situation subprime. Oh, nobody knows what that means. Subprime. That means prime is good credit. Subprime is not good credit, less than good credit. So we'll call it something that people really won't follow, and we'll tell you what. We're going to have people lend you money, though you are a subprime borrower, and I will figure out some government agencies to guarantee your loan, though I don't think you're a good risk. So the banks say, no, 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 we don't want, initially, the banks said, sorry, this is too risky, Mr. President, for us. We're in the business of managing risk. It's not our money. It's the hard-working people's money sitting in our bank. We can't lend to people whose credit is not prime. You're asking us to lend to people who are subprime. And he says, here's the key, if you don't, Mr. Bannon, I'm going to make sure the Justice Department charges you with discriminatory lending because you refuse to lend to my subprimers. In business terms, you should never lend to. But what we'll do is I'm going to form an agency called Fannie Mae and Ginny Mae, just another agency names. They'll guarantee your loan. So don't worry. Don't worry. You don't have to pay it back anymore. Even though and maybe you don't even have to work as hard anymore. That's probably a harsh statement, but these players, these two big firms, Fannie Mae and Ginny Mae, will guarantee the fact that that bank will receive its money. Now, the bank says, wow, best deal in history. I refused to lend to Mr. Bannon, but now he has the big brother, his Uncle Sam. He went to his Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam says, I'm guaranteeing it. The bank says, I want everybody. Give me as many people as you can give me, because Uncle Sam is the best credit in the world. Not only that, it's the United States government. We'll take it all. We'll take as much subprime as we can handle, because it's the best credit. investment for the moment. It's a strange investment because it has politics that has inserted its way into the numbers. Politics doesn't belong in the markets, but now we're going to have, I want the votes, we'll make guarantees that you who can't get a house normally will be able to get a house from the bank. The bank says, this is the best deal in history. We will package 100, 300, 1,000 of you subprimers, and we'll sell it off to somebody else. And the whole system becomes mired in subprime mortgages. That's becomes the
what
issue.
What do you mean mired? This is too well, much supply. Is the supply-demand problem? You get too much supply?
No, it's a very good question. What does too much supply mean? Well, then you get to people, go back to your first question to me. Government leaders. Government leaders know if they're good, and they can do mathematics, they can balance their checkbooks. So certain people in Congress said, well, how do you value these subprime mortgages? The banks say, we've been valuing them the same way we've always valued them for the past 20 years. The accounting firms, there's something in this country called GAAP accounting, which is a standard type of accounting. And we account for them the same way we've always accounted for them. If we paid $1,000 for your mortgage last night, when we put it on our books today, we're going to say its value is $1,000. Makes sense. I paid for it. What's its value? It's $1,000. That's what I paid for it last night. No. The Congress people said, that's not really a good answer, you know. That doesn't give us confidence that you know what you're doing. Because what happens if you have to sell it tomorrow morning? Something's happened and you have to sell it. Remember, there's a kind of stress tests. Would you be able to value it at what you paid for it the day before? And Wall Street says, that's not the way you can think about this. This is crazy. We always value things at the cost from the day before. And they changed the accounting method, in essence, to say not what it was worth yesterday, but if I have to sell, what would it be worth? That's impossible. So what happens is every bank now has to value something that they bought yesterday at lower than they paid. Never before in 20 years did they have to do this. So something they bought at 1,000, on their books was 1,000, is now 990. That starts to, you asked the question about what did I start to think about. Something's 1,000 and 990, this person now has to value it at 980.
When did you first start to get nervous, understanding Bill Clinton in all this? Did you change glasses?
Yes.
Okay.
I changed shirt.
I saw the black.
Are you okay with the...
Yeah, great. I think we're going to have all kinds of changes.
I'm experimenting. Yeah. Okay.
When did you get a feeling? Did you ever anticipate, before it happened, something like 2008 could happen?
No.
How could that be?
It's the word I can beat it to death, is that it's very much like anticipate I'll have a heart attack tomorrow? Unlikely.
Was 2008 a heart attack or a stroke? Debilitating.
It was both. But why was it both? Because, in fact, as I said, the blood was getting dried up in the system, and the head, which is sort of the central bank, wasn't working. So to some extent, it was a combination. It was just a crisis.
Did you see that building up over time?
It's always been lurking in the background. I mean, if you have an older parent, would you say it's possible? Did you anticipate him having a heart attack today? No, you hope things are going to go better and maybe they'll fix it up. The system was getting too complex, and it wasn't based on derivatives, because what people keep forgetting, and as I was just explaining, Wall Street, and in many professions, including Wall Street makes it sound complicated. They don't want the little guy to understand what they do because they make so much money and they don't do very much. So they couch it in words like derivative and stock options and commodity futures and different types of contracts. It's all fairly, everyone is capable of understanding it. It is not complicated. But Wall Street, because they make so much money from doing fairly simple things, needs to make it more complicated than it really is.
We had a very big recession in the early 90s based upon real estate and Japan basically imploding.
You had a recession in the 90s. I don't know what it's based upon. It's always interesting to look back and say, separate from there's certain triggers, like there, in the 70s there was a...
What do you think it was based upon, the 90s downturn? It's clearly there was a huge downturn.
No, I know there was a downturn. That's what I know for sure.
That's a fact.
Everything else is sort of speculation about why did he have that?
I understand that, but there's some speculation that has 0% probability of being true, and there's others that have 90%. In the range, when you look at the range of alternatives of what could have caused it in 90, and what I'm trying to do is get you all the way up to 2008. Look, you're the smartest guy in the room, right? You know that. Do you think there's anybody in the world today?
Oops, this is going to be a bad question.
Do you think anybody in the world today, the Alan Greenspans, the Bernankes, is there any central banker you know, any partner of any Wall Street firm, any guy running a trading desk, and I would take it that would be, or anybody at a Larry Fink at BlackRock, Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone, the top 100 financial guys, and let's throw in a couple of Nobel economists, and let's throw in the best professors at Wharton, at Harvard, at Stanford. Do you think that there's anybody that understands money or understands the world's financial system as good as you?
There must be.
But it doesn't come to the top of the head?
No.
Okay, fine. Now that I've gotten that, let's go back to 1990. In that arc from 90, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to 2008.
Good.
We started with the implosion in Tokyo of the Japanese economy, Japanese financial markets. We had the huge run-up in internet stocks, right? We had the implosion of that in 2000. The bankruptcy of Drexel Burnham in 90. Mm-hmm. Implosion of Japan, huge run-up in equity markets for the internet, implosion of the internet in 2000, 10 years later roughly. Mm-hmm. And then this run-up through the Iraq War and all that, the run-up to 2008. Every 10 years, it seems like, we're in some sort of 10 years before the 1990s was the 70s.
Sound like an astrologer.
Okay.
And not a financial person.
You're a mathematician. It just seems to me a pattern of every 10 years.
That's misleading. That's exactly right. Okay. Because people like to see patterns. People like to see patterns where there are none.
So a pattern of a financial crisis every 10 years is just in my mind.
Yes.
Long-term capital that had to be bailed out back in the late 90s when everybody panicked. And that wasn't a big – that bailout today would look small. And it was $5 billion or it was $30 billion.
Businesses fail all the time.
But long-term capital, and the Federal Reserve stepped in.
But I'm saying people go bad. Things go bad all the time.
Yes. You're correct. The audience is watching this, the little guys, they go bankrupt all the time and nobody gives a shit. You know why? They're a little guy. But when long-term capital management goes bankrupt, or Bear Stearns goes bankrupt, or Lehman Brothers goes bankrupt, people care because...
It's an unfair characterization.
Why do you say that?
Because, again, it's the complexity of the situation. If you think about think you have a complex system, you have your body. Now, in fact, the little guy is my finger.
Bear Stearns is your heart.
That's correct. The banking system is my heart. The system, I can't risk my because remember,
okay,
it's not
so
only my...
You haven't been able to name...
Hang on.
You haven't...
What, I wanted to see if the hang on worked.
You're not good enough yet. You're like junior wizard trying to do it. You haven't... Yes. I'll say, since we can't name another guy that's as good as you, there may be a couple out there. You're not bragging. You're humble. It had to be sometime. Please tell me there was sometime before you went to jail and basically got cut off from daily information in the summer of 2008, that you started to get very nervous that this complex system, that something was deeply wrong.
Okay, first, let's go back. When I say no one understands the system better than I do, it doesn't mean I
understand. You always sound like a doctor. You're afraid he's going to get sued for giving a thing. Yes, you're not taking on any liability. There's no contingent liability here for your answers.
But the word understand is the problem. Okay. I don't understand the system. So that's, I don't understand the financial system.
Please stop. You cannot sit here and tell me. We just went through, I'll go through again. The hedge fund managers, the money managers, the central bankers, the commercial bankers, the heads of the investment banks, the heads of all the trading desks, the top economists, and I'll throw in the business school lectures at Stanford. Of all the top 200, 250, you can't name at the top of your head the guys who are at least at your level. You have to understand it somewhat.
No. Sorry. We all don't understand it. No one understands it. It's a miracle. It's that's part of the problem. It's impossible to understand. That word understand simply means if this happens here, that will happen there. It's predictable. Understanding means it's predictable. It's not predictable. That's the problem. It's very, in complex systems, that was the fascination. Is there a way to tease out some level of predictability?
In fact, you would ask
the question. It's a great question, which was it a stroke or a heart attack? Now, most people don't know that before they were going to have a stroke, they had a stroke. They just have a stroke. Do they understand why? In hindsight, you go back and you can make lots of explanations that might sound good. And if you're talking to the working man, you're using language that he'll never understand. It's complex. So he, just like going to his doctor, he says he has a gastrointestinal problem, or he has diverticulitis, as opposed to saying, you had a stomach ache, you ate bad food. People don't like to say it in normal, everyman terms. The system had a stroke, and we don't know why.
But you just, okay. Hardworking people, and there's a great social benefit, would you not agree, with having people having ownership in the system?
When you say ownership in the system, it doesn't mean...
Let's start over. Flip over your phone, too, because
yes.
I don't want anyone to see this on your phone. So maybe flip it down or something.
Yeah,
who knows what the fuck comes up with that?
That's correct.
We don't want to send you
KSA.
I can't not believe I've got the magic moment when you're in fucking prison or jail, wherever the fuck it is.
It's crazy.
Solitary.
Now, there's a funny part to that we missed, which is said.
Oh, go ahead, can you tell it.
The funny part is what you asked me.
Is there anything funnier than that?
No.
For black humor, it's.
I don't make any black comments. Sorry. You asked me what I was wearing.
That's right. You're too wrapped up in the Me Too movement.
Yes. So I was wearing a brown jumper and a brown pair of pants given to me by the jail with the word trustee on the back.
Because you had qualified to be a trustee?
Well, the funny part was it was spelled T-R-U-S-T-Y. So I wasn't really sure. I'd been a trustee in many different operations, but it was the first time it was actually printed on my back and spelled incorrectly.
Probably had a higher level of being a trustee at that than you had at all the boards that you were trustees, right?
Yes, because as the trustee meant you get two devices to clean your toilet as opposed to one.
Yeah, but it also meant that you had some sort of personal fiduciary own responsibility for oneself, right?
In the jail?
Well, that's what being a trustee is. That's where they give you two.
You get two cleaners. I was a trustee in the jail because I was able to teach some of the kids to help them get their GED. So that's how they gave me a trustee job.
There's no time. I got to go back to this because it's. I'm like a dog with a bone in this thing.
Yes.
You can't. There's something deeply fucked up with you.
At least something.
Well, we know there are things deeply fucked up with this. You will get through in this film. Right. But you cannot possibly have sit there knowing that you came from nowhere, knowing that you went to the very top of what is considered outside of science and maybe physics, the thing people most admire because it's like alchemy, understanding high finance, to sit there in what will be the defining financial crisis of our time, like Black Friday and or Black Monday, whatever it was, in the Great Depression, and be there at that exact moment, triggered in part by a firm that you used to be a partner in and knew intimately well and created much of your initial net worth because of, and know that you couldn't, someone who lives on a phone, right?
Yes.
Because you do live on a phone, right?
Correct.
You had to make collect calls. You cannot tell me sometime during that day you did not have that conversation with yourself of how the fuck did I do this to myself to put myself in West Palm Beach in a 6x9 cell with a metal fucking bed with a brown shirt that said trustee spelled wrong.
So did I find it amazing that I was there? That's a
not amazing. And I don't want to say it was not funny. Oh,
I wasn't funny.
Right. But not amazing.
It was incredible.
Incredible in what way? Like, how do I do this to myself?
No. It's as incredible as me sitting here in this house. They're both just two sides of the coin. That's how I think about it. That my life today is incredible.
Do you consider yourself a stoic?
No. I consider myself a hermit. Stoics are not very happy.
Being a hermit then, being in that 6x9 cell, being in the cell, qua the cell, was not the problem, right?
Correct.
What was the problem?
The eating the Almond Joy bars.
Because you couldn't eat the food.
No, right. And there, but remember, my life is...
Did that ever strike you that I can't eat the food? Because somebody might have done something to it. I gotta live off an Almond Joy bar, one a day or two a day or whatever. How many ever sneak in a day?
No sneaking in.
Your one Almond Joy bar, did that not hit you at some time? How the fuck did I do this?
No.
Let's go back to the spring of 2008. Were you so wrapped up in your personal issues at the time you were not spending enough time on the financial markets, or were you deeply involved in the financial markets like you normally were?
I was involved.
And so we're saying that the smartest guy in the room didn't see it coming?
No, of course
not.
The
bankruptcy of Bear Stearns, you just thought was a Bear Stearns problem. You didn't see it as systemic.
I know you keep hopping on it, but it's not...
Because you're a mathematician and understand systems. It seems that anybody that understands that they had a systemic problem, you at least be the first on the early search radar. If you're not going to see it, then I'm really afraid. Because that means that I always assume there's at least a set of guys out there that have some sort of sense that something's not right.
Imagine the guy who has a stroke or had the heart attack... When you ask him, did you feel funny the day before? He's going to tell you, yeah, I didn't feel right. Something was off. I didn't feel right. I had my stomach was right. I felt a little dizzy. I felt a little weak. But if you asked him that day before, do you think you're going to have a heart attack tomorrow? He'd say, no, I just feel a little weak. I'm a little dizzy. My stomach hurts. So these systems, and that's the issue of complexity. What complexity says is that, in fact, this everything seems to go along, and people have seen it. One of the great examples of complex systems is sand dunes. In fact, the sand keeps building up. People have seen some, and all of a sudden, one more sand drop, and all the sand starts running down the hills. That's the way I see the financial markets.
When you funded Santa Fe in the early 90s or late 80s?
I believe it was early 90s. I can get back to you.
But early 90s, Santa Fe was funded for the study of complexity theory.
It was studied with math. So let's back up. So why did I buy a ranch in New Mexico in 1993? So that gives you some sense. So I would have funded it in 1990. Los Alamos, which was the high-energy lab up in New Mexico, was losing all its scientists.
And Los Alamos, it was where Oppenheimer and where a lot of the nuclear weapons program, the bomb.
That's where the Manhattan Project.
Manhattan Project was Los Alamos, and you bought your property out in New Mexico to be near that?
Yes, because the scientists were going to be, they cut the funding for high energy physics. But the people who worked in Los Alamos would still be in the Santa Fe area.
They cut that because this was the Cold War dividend, right?
I don't remember exactly why. It was because, again, people thought there was that physics and high-energy physics really wasn't that important.
Because that was about nuclear weapons.
No, it was because they were trying. They decided, which may be not right, this was the same time that Murray Gell-Mann came up with the term quark, Q-U-A-R-K. He picked it out of an old poem, the word quark. But it was something, it was mysterious. So they were starting to understand in the 90s that our world of the physics world, there was things that were just unexplainable. They called it strange things. You gave it a name. You gave it some characteristics. You called it, it had charm, was one of the terms. It had a charm. It had a flavor. It had a color. But nobody really, no one, Mr. Bannon, understood what it was, just like the financial system.
And you wanted to investigate that?
I wanted to see if we could build tools so others smarter than me could help investigate it.
And that was the beginning of your concept of the Santa Fe Institute?
Yes.
And Santa Fe Institute was founded to do study in this type of...
Can these areas of strange things be described by some form of mathematics?
So that's what I'm trying to get at. The foundational thought, the organizing principle of Santa Fe in the high physics lab at Los Alamos, which had created been the headquarters of Manhattan and the Trinity Project, right? The bomb.
Yes.
So you're talking about the elite, the high priest
of physics.
Of physics.
Yes, sir.
Which high priest of physics? Some subset of that is also mathematics.
Yes, they're both similar.
Project out. One of the tools you want to do is to make sure that in this complex system, the finance system, I'm doing a lot of this for philanthropy and a lot for the good of mankind, but also to be able to understand this complex system, the most complex outside of maybe our body, of the financial world.
Yes.
Did they create tools, or were you smarter in than the mid-aughts, 15 years later, than you had been then because of work that was done at Santa Fe?
No. It was great. But in fact, most of the money, most of my philanthropy in the area of can you describe things that appear to be unexplainable by mathematics, and can you fund people who have new ideas? And unfortunately, when someone thinks they've been able to, there was a man, Stuart Kaufman, when they think that, okay, I figured out how to be able to predict the unpredictable, what appears to other people to be unpredictable. But my system, in those days it was called genetic algorithms, can predict what things will happen, then they all want to make money. So they use their systems to try to figure out, they know they have figured out the way to make money because they figured out the unexplainable. They try, they go bankrupt, and we start again. So with a cold view, what I've come to realize is that the attempt to mathematize, formularize, or what in your prior work, to understand what really is, in today's world, still unexplainable, is impossible. They're miracles.
Your first head of Santa Fe was Christopher...
Langdon, I think.
Langdon, from Australia.
But Murray Gell-Mann was really the funder. He was the rock.
Yes, he was the rock. He was a Nobel Prize winner?
Yes.
Yes, and a wonderful guy. He came out and helped us with the Biosphere 2 project. He came with Chris Langdon.
Yes.
Chris Langdon was the operator, the day-to-day guy.
Chris was doing artificial life.
Right.
Murray tried to lead his own artificial life.
Yes. When Chris came to Biosphere 2 for the first big conference we had in 1994, he was one of the most impressive guys there among all the world's elite. Kew Gardens, the Lawrence Livermore Lab, the labs at Sandia, all the major universities, Lamont Doherty, all the big Earth observatories, Woods Hole. What set Langdon apart, I thought, and the reason I invited Santa Fe to be part of it, was Langdon actually made a presentation that everything, and he was making this to scientists, a lot of marine biologists, a lot of people that are just beginning, Wally Broker and people who are just beginning the study of climate change, at that time called global warming, that he made this compelling presentation that everything's really mathematics.
Yes.
It's all just back to math. And you have to, all these experiments you do, you're not, one of the reasons they're not considered by the high priest in physics as being real experiments is that they don't have a mathematical basis to it, and everything has a mathematical basis to it. Langdon seemed like a radical visionary. What happened to that concept?
You go back 350 years. So you have Isaac Newton, you have Leibniz. From move forward, you have people like Heisenberg and Gödel, and what every one of those mathematicians and philosophers came to understand is that there's something with, there's numbers can describe certain things, approximate certain things. But in fact, trying to put measurements and numbers on other things that are really unexplainable is folly. It's so 300 years ago, they said that unexplainable realm was God. And people who attempted, in fact, to explain the unexplainable, who said, yes, I understand the unexplainable, were charlatans, they were the occults, they were the astrologers, they were the con men.
Alchemist.
Yes. Well, no, alchemist was, in fact, they believed that there was a way to transmute one metal into another. In fact, they always wanted to see if they can create gold. There's no reason, if you think about it, they recognized that one metal is different than another metal because it has some additional pieces to it. It has additional neutrons or protons or electrons. So because they thought it was a machine, they believed it was a machine, if I can take five protons and add five, that gives me 10, I should be able to get gold. Move everything around inside these systems, the molecules transmute one molecule into another, and if this molecule I've transmuted it into is gold, I'm a rich man. It's back to money. But this something strange happens. Isaac Newton says, this is really weird. If I want to push a ball on the table, I have to touch it. Maybe I have to blow on it. But I actually have to push one side of the ball or the book to move that side. I'm pushing here, and obviously this thing is what appears to us humans to be solid, so it moves as one thing. But the only way to get something to move was to touch it or put a force against it. Okay, seems to make sense. Everybody has that experience. You know, I want to lift a glass, I lift it. If I want to push a ball, I push it. If I want to pull a ball, I pull it. But he recognized when the ball fell off the table, it went in a different direction. How is that possible? Nobody pushed the ball down. And he said, this is crazy. Why did the ball go down? I didn't push it. I just let it go. So someone's pushing the ball. Because I know that I am confident that the only thing that gets something to move is with a force that pushes. So there's a force that's pushing the ball down. In fact, he called it gravity. He measured how fast it was pulled, but never was able to explain why it happened. How is it? What is gravity? It's this. Everybody says, well, why did the ball fall to the ground? Because gravity took it. But what's gravity? That's, as Feynman would say, that's the name of the thing. We have no idea what it is. This goes to Santa Fe. They were trying to explain the unexplainable. Can we measure? Can we figure out a way to predict the stock markets using these types of chaos complexity?
Before we get there, let's walk back through. Let's go back to Newton.
Sure.
Pre-Newton. And then Newton. What did Newton solve that for millennia up to Newton had not been solved? And then I want to go forward all the way to Santa Fe, what they were trying to solve. Let's start with just two or three of the basic guys, but let's go with Newton. What pre-Newton, it was what? And then why is Newton such a
genius?
I think mathematically they told me one time, or I've seen there's been 115 billion people roughly that have lived on the Earth. And of that 115 billion, Newton.
Are you sure that's a number? That sounds a lot, very high. We only have seven now.
I think in the history of the Earth, I'll pull up the stat for you, but I think it's 115 billion people. They figured
that probably is inflation. That's why you see.
have lived through on Earth. But he's one of the handful of the most important. What did he solve for? Why is he so important for how we live today? And then we want to go through Leibniz and the other two or three other major ones to get us to Santa Fe.
Well, that's a long, it's a long journey.
This is the heart of what we're trying to do.
Let me take a bit of a detour just a second. What if you went to high school and the last year in your high school, you took calculus. So Isaac Newton sort of invents calculus. Well, that sounds invents, you know, mathematicians.
To torture seniors in high school before they graduate.
Yes, but obviously, no, yes, the answer is yes. Certain people can never do calculus.
Why is it? Why is calculus so, why is that the dividing line between, you know, to me, people who can handle that and can go on to do certain things and people just hit the wall, even if they know math? It seems to me that there's... That calculus is the thing that changes. It bridges. That's because it's about the theory of change and the theory of how things change.
It's a great question, but in fact, what calculus does is it's somewhat philosophical. That's why mathematics Newton wasn't a mathematician. He was called a geometer. That's what they used to call themselves. They understood geometry and numbers. But there's an old conundrum where it says during Pythagoras days, Zeno's paradox, it's called, where they said, well, if the wall is 2 feet away from me, and I take one step that's halfway to the wall, that'll be 1 foot away, and if I take another step that's half again, that'll be half a foot away, and then a quarter of a foot, I could walk forever but never touch the wall. Doesn't sound realistic, doesn't make any sense in our real lives of the physical. But what Newton understood is many problems were like that. Many things approached the wall, or in calculus, approached the limit, but never really reached it. So he said, it's okay, you don't have to reach it. We can do lots of the mathematics as if it was so close, it was almost there. And we could do lots of mathematics almost being at the limit. And this is really important, Steve, for today. Because most of the science up until today was things that are starting to approach the limit. You were taught in high school that if you had 1 divided by 0, if you remember your high school algebra, you were told, what's the answer to that? Is there an answer to 1 divided by 0? No, if you were in high school, I'd say, stay away from it. It's the boogeyman. You could write it down as it's undefined. It's not able to be determined. There's a bunch of things. But in fact, 1 divided by 0 is a strange thing's happen. It's a world of the strange. And what I'll explain to you after is that when you get 1 divided by 0, you get into a world we don't know what happens. The answer is it's not explainable. We can give it, we can call it things like undetermined. We can have a convention to say it's X, Y, or Z. But in real life, we don't know what happens when you are actually at the limit. So that's Newton thought the same concept, is that the limits were God. You got close to God, but you can never be God. He had this sort of religious interpretation.
Okay, I want to go back to Newton. Why is Newton such a big dividing line in mankind's history? What is it about Newton? What is it about what he's trying to solve? What did they not know beforehand? And what? Because we live, to a degree, in a Newtonian universe, although I realized later, subparticle atomic physics, but at least for a while, it was Newtonian. So what's the dividing line? Why is he so important? Why is he an inflection point in mankind's movement from the swamp to the stars?
It's a great question. The stars were by Kepler. What Newton starts to allow us to do is to make accurate predictions. Remember that we've talked about that with money, about the things in our physical world, how cars, he didn't have cars, that how horse carriages moved, how bowling balls moved, how pool cues and pool pool table balls.
Had people tried to solve that before Newton? Heraclitus or Plotinus, Pythagoras, had these greats that we hear about,
had they tried to solve the same problem?
Not the same problem. They tried to again, what Pythagoras does, he starts to figure out this relationships in triangles. For example, everyone knows the a squared plus b squared is equal to c squared, that Pythagorean theorem, which is basically says these shapes in a triangle, each side of the triangle has a fixed relationship with the other two sides. That's strange. He knew, again, but it was all numbers. This was a system of things in the physical world, and Pythagoras says, we can start putting numbers on things that help you predict how they will behave. You can add two triangles and make a square, some different shapes. They were looking at geometric forms. Newton says, well, I want to know how planets move. I want to know how things around me move. Can we find formulas? Can I find formulas that explain what I see in the physical world, how physical things interact and how they describe one another? Again, the fact that two things, two solid masses, for some very strange, unknown reason, unknown today, attract one another, no matter what they are. People have seen the experiment. You hang something, two little metal balls from a string, and they move towards each other. In fact, they move towards each other was a very, very specific. So when you drop the ball to the floor of this room, Newton says, in fact, the room came up a bit to meet the ball. The room moved. It's imperceptible. You can't really perceive that motion, but they attracted each other with certain ratios. So he started to be able to measure things in the physical world. And that was great advances. It also, now you wanted to move very quickly. Unfortunately, most people, especially in the 20th century, 19th century, said, well, like Newton, let's measure everything. Let's measure people's behavior. Let's measure their psychology. Let's measure their health. You go to the, we can have my blood test. Let's measure everything.
Their voting habits.
Measure, measure, measure. Can we put a number on how much I care for my wife? Can I put a number on how I feel? And we tried, unfortunately, we try to mathematize the finer things in life and then recognize that there's things that fortunately just fall outside. Schrodinger wrote a very famous book about what is life. He was trying to figure out a way, can he describe the difference formulaically between things that are alive and things that are dead? The answer is no. The things that are alive in my world are miracles. Not magic. Magic has a bad connotation.
We don't believe in you don't believe in the spirit or the soul. That's what animates people, is your spirit or your soul. That's
no.
Have you ever seen someone die? When they die, their spirit leaves.
Their soul leaves, no question. So in
there's
fact,
no question to you about
no
that.
No question.
There's no question to you that there is some animating life force within us that leaves when you're dead.
Yes, in fact, I refer to the soul. This obviously a certain... the questions in the past, even
because
during
people would normally think you were soulless. So,
thank you.
Have you talk about you actually believe in it, and have done some thinking about it? It's pretty shocking in its own right, isn't it?
Well, Leibniz thought.
So, Newton was at Cambridge, and he was the head of the math department, right? He's a professor, essentially.
Yes.
A German professor?
Yes, but what Leibniz said is, the soul is so strange because God took chemicals, which is simply the material, like tables, and he somehow made this material able to have a thought. How strange is that? Not only does it have a soul, but this some way it was put together that this material substance is able to think. So when you say to me, it's obvious to everyone that there's such a thing as a soul. Now, if you're part of the charlatanville, you'll try to explain it to people. The soul, I describe, is the dark matter of the brain. Why is it dark matter? Because in high-energy physics nowadays, you hear terms of dark matter, dark energy. Again, terminology. It's a complicated term. Why is it dark matter? Because we can't see it. That's all. What do you mean you can't see it? Well, somehow we see something moving towards this area of darkness. Something, I can see this thing. This appears to me to be empty. It's just black. But I see it being drawn this way. So I say, well, I know if this were matter, that would follow that equation. If this was solid, it would explain the way this particle moves. But I can't see anything here. So I'll just call it dark matter. And I'll say, I don't know what it is, but it behaves as if there was something there. The soul is obvious to everyone that there's something different between things that are alive and things that are not alive. But we have no idea what it is. It's currently unexplainable. I believe we need an entirely different system of analysis to try to figure out.
But
sorry.
No. With Newton, you know, with all his alchemical studies and things he worked on the spiritual side, Leibniz had just talked about the soul, Schroeder talked about what is life. If a modern scientist or someone that you funded at MIT or at Harvard or one of these things talked in those types of terms, they would be considered to be a wingnut today, wouldn't they? They would not be on the path for tenure, right?
Unless they were in the philosophy department.
This is exactly my point. We're talking about three of the greatest mathematicians in mankind's history that have really changed mankind. Talking like this, what happened? How do we get to a situation where they could not be in the high physics, you know, they could not be in the mathematics department or working in physics?
Good, it's an easy answer. Newton was a combination of mathematician or geometer then and philosopher. And as time went on, that those disciplines seemed to move apart. We had philosophy. Some of the philosophers can't do math, and some of the mathematicians. And again, mathematicians often break into two categories. People that solve problems. Those are more like geometers in the old days, just problem solvers. And then there's thinkers, theoreticians. They're more like the old movement towards philosophy. But neither one of those two groups have been able to figure out why something is alive as opposed to something that's not alive. No one's been able to describe what the soul is, but we all know it exists. And I think what we need is a new... Science is a bad word. I think science only describes the things we already know about the physical world. In fact, there's an argument that the physical world that we see has been created out of our systems of mathematics. Mathematics, everyone knows mathematics describes the physical world much greater than it should, unless you, my view, the physical world really comes out of conscious beings that have mathematics. So they create it. This table appears to you and I to be solid. To a bat, because we have light that's bouncing off the table into our eyes, it appears solid. If instead of eyes that responded to wavelengths of visual light, our eyes responded to radio waves, the radio frequencies. It's not different. It's the same type of frequency as light, but different speeds. The table's invisible. We know that our phone works in this room. So the waves are coming through the windows. The waves are coming through the walls. So the walls are invisible to that type of radiation, that type of energy. The walls are, I can see them because my eyes, a physical system, determines that the walls are there.
You, with Murray Gell-Mann, you founded, or were the original donor, and had the idea of Santa Fe Institute. In 10 or 15 years later, that effort to study the complexity of systems mathematically.
Yes.
It was a total failure.
Total failure.
Why is that?
It's the failure of science because, in fact, if to some extent science doesn't describe romance. I don't know why I'm attracted to somebody. I don't know. People are attracted to each other and everyone has the same feeling. They've seen someone walk in the room and they say, oh, that person gives me a creepy feeling. Science has tried to describe. Science doesn't describe what creepy feelings means. They just know it's a creepy feeling. I think women as I said the last time, have an intuitive sense. What is intuitive? They have intuition, they have feelings, and they're able to deal in the realm of things that men, especially men like myself, find unexplainable. They have great, women have intuition, men see things a bit differently. Men want to measure everything. Women are not really that interested in measuring.
In what you're saying in macro terms, you actually think science, mathematics, maybe ultimately technology, is moving to that more intuitive?
I think science and math are old-fashioned. And unfortunately, people are still taught that they have to learn algebra in school and certain things in school, as opposed to learning to have an emotional...
Is this what Larry Summers was trying to get at? Maybe didn't say it perfectly enough, but what he was trying to get to in that system, the systems we study today, the way mathematics is either taught or understood, that women just haven't gotten up to the highest realms of engineering or physics or mathematics because of that, and you're actually implying that there's a either new branch of science or we've hit an inflection point like in Newton that's going to go in a... Newton took mankind in a different direction because he was able to measure. Then you had subatomic, you know, non-Newtonian physics later. Are you saying that you think there's another developing field that's coming up that may take us, I don't know, how many decades to get our hands around, but that's what's evolving out of this?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I think that mathematics, it's not the end of science. Every year someone says it's the end of, we can't discover everything. There's lots to discover with relationship to the physical world, but we know a lot already. In respect to the unexplainable world, we almost know nothing. Women, again, sense it. And instead of Larry Summers, I won't digress too much, but Howard Gardner early on said, there's not one form of intelligence. It's not mathematical intelligence. There's emotional intelligence, this kinesthetic intelligence. You know, there's this argument that I reject that black people are less intelligent than white people. It's not true. We know, for example, that if I was in the forest and I had to run from the lion or figure out a way not to be eaten, and my competition is a local African, I'm the one who's getting eaten because they have the intelligence to deal with their local environment. So it's just different. It's not better, it's not worse, but there's many differences amongst different types of people. And so people have different intelligences and they excel in some intelligences usually and less so in others.
When did it come to, because the world of high finance is a world of pure reason, or is it a lot of emotion and gut checks and you know, on trading desk and central banks when these decisions get made? Is it that high church, like the high church of science of high energy physics, or is it as much emotion that comes in as much as the mathematics and the reason?
It's a great question. I think if you talk to really experienced and successful traders, and you ask them how they know what's going on, they can't give you an answer. They don't know. They feel it. They can feel the way the market's moving. They can feel the way the stock's moving. And that these are not very well-defined terms. It's difficult to put in mathematics terms, how did I feel it? You could look back and make guesses what I was seeing. But great traders feel it and then act on their feelings. That's the difference. Many people feel it but are afraid because they want a mathematical justification before they take that next step.
When you first got on the trading desk at Bear Stearns in the late 70s or mid-70s, were you shocked by how little actual understanding of mathematics that the traders comprehended?
Yeah, well, again, we had a Texas Instrument calculator. Most stockbrokers, especially before 1975, if they were good stockbrokers, could add. That's about it. They could multiply. If you could multiply, you were already in the top 15% of stockbrokers. Stockbrokers simply meant there's a story. When I went to the first person, I had no money. And I said, how much money do you make a year? And he said, $400,000. I said, impossible. I'm making $10,000.
That's probably more than your family had made in his entire
life.
Existence.
Yes. And he makes that in a year. I said, what do you do? And he said, it's too complicated for you to understand. Which is what the main thrust of Wall Street people, they want to tell you it's too complicated. Because if you understood that that person was simply, he had a brother-in-law, in fact, in this case, who ran the pension fund of General Motors. His brother-in-law would call him and say, buy 1,000 IBM. He'd hang up the phone, he'd write it out on a ticket and walk it to a window. That was his entire skill set. Hello, write what my brother-in-law says, walk it to a ticket window.
Give me an example when you were on the trading desk in the early days of Bear Stearns of a time that you felt either complete uncertainty or you saw total panic, where people, something was happening that people couldn't foretell and that they were like in an airplane cockpit where it's going wrong. Walk us through that.
In 1978, I think it was, across the news wires, there had been a collapse of the currency in Thailand. On the other side of the world, had no relationship to me. I wasn't sure where Thailand was. But the fact that a currency, a country's money, had all of a sudden dropped tremendously in value affected the rest of the world's markets. And people panicked because they'd never seen that before. A very small part of a very complex system had a shock throughout the whole system. So prices on Park Avenue apartments, the bond markets, the stock markets, every started to gyrate. You know, there's an old mathematics expression that if a butterfly wings in Mexico make the wrong turn, it spins out, and eventually, by the time it gets to Canada, it turns into a tornado. So these are part of complex systems. So yeah, Wall Street in certain parts.
Santa Fe Institute was supposed to actually come up with a formula for that, for the butterfly wings. Why in 15 years did you reach the end of at least that experiment?
Every attempt to, that's why it's so exciting now, because I think certain people are starting to realize that there's so many things that are unexplainable that we have to think about them differently. Music is a great example. It's a common man's example. You know, when you hear a certain song, it makes you feel a certain way. How does it do that? We don't know. We can't mathematize it. And even that music, Steve, nowadays we compress music. When you have a violin, it's compressed onto your iPhone. So what does compression mean? I'm taking lots of information and I'm cutting it into lots of pieces and squishing it together. And when I squish it or compress it, I have to take out lots of pieces, but I say that they're not very important pieces. It's those pieces that we take out when we compress data, to me, are the most interesting parts of life.
You just said a while ago, part of this new search for science may go back to when people were actually talking about a soul, and you said there's no doubt in your mind that there is a soul. Describe for me what you mean by that. What do you mean by soul? What do you mean soul different than the physical analog body that we're seeing on film right now?
It's difficult to describe in words. I mean, I'm not a poet. Poems get a little closer to what that really means. But we can, even the concept of what is life becomes complicated when you deal with plants and seeds. Is a seed alive? I don't know. Certain people would say, no, it's dead. When you're a banana, one of my favorite examples is the banana that's sitting on the countertop in your kitchen today. Is it alive or dead?
What do you think about human life? Tell me about human life.
But your banana is alive. That banana is breathing. It's on your... You say, that's impossible, Jeffrey. No, it's not.
Is the banana conscious?
All these words... These are words... So everyone's trying to fit a very complicated concepts into a very small box called conscious or alive. These don't fit in that way. So if you put your banana in a bag and put another fruit in with it, the fruit ripens faster because the banana breathes with it. We don't understand most of those things. So you asked the question. Sorry.
You talk about the life. What about human life?
What about it?
Tell me, what do you think? What do you think human life is?
It's a miracle. It's a miracle. And when I say miracle, I can't explain it, and I make no attempt to explain it at the moment. This, we don't know how to think about it. And anyone, again, another one of the Feynman quotes when he was talking about quantum physics, he said, anyone, Jeffrey, who says they understand quantum physics and quantum mechanics and quantum behavior, you know they're lying.
Let's talk about it. That's post-Newtonian. Talk about what's the difference, who founded quantum mechanics, why is quantum mechanics taking Newtonian physics and taking it to the next level?
It forms a much broader category.
Let's go back to this desk. You use the thing of Newton using this desk. What is why can't Newton's theory explain everything? Why did subatomic quantum mechanics or quantum physics have to come in to explain this?
Well, let's go right back to square one. Why is it called quantum physics? So quanta is a word that simply means packet, small amount. So it's quantized. So we recognized, when we recognized that this table appears, another very complicated word, solid to us, it's really made up of molecules or atoms. And atoms, we've given lots of names to what some of the behaviors. If you were in school, when you and I were in school in the 50s, the model was a little center thing in the middle, and an electron went around and around it. It was seen as a ball that went around and around it. And as we started to look at, say, well, let's see what this ball looks like. I want to be able to examine that little thing called an electron. We found that there was nothing there. There wasn't the thing. It was simply a cloud of energy that we can call an electron. So we already started to see mysterious things as we go into very super small quantities, quantum physics. So quantum physics started to go into the very small and very small distances. We see things that we can't explain, just cannot explain.
How am I doing on time?
4 minutes.
Fine.
And to summarize, no, sorry.
Let's go back to human life. When do you think human life starts?
It's not these. So you see, this is the question. You're asking me to measure something again. It's the
disease. It can't be measured. You just hate making commitments.
That's
measure,
why I'm not married.
I'm peeling this onion back a layer at a time. All your bullshit and happy talk, it can't be measured, can't be measured like that, is that to say measure makes it's a commitment. You don't even like a commitment when you answer a question.
I don't.
As they say in golf, commit to the shot.
I don't know what it means to be measured.
You do know what it means to be measured. You're one of the leading currency traders, hedge fund guys, or stock market financial wizards. You're in the high priesthood of high finance. You certainly know how to measure. That's why you're a billionaire. Any other answer besides that is total and complete bullshit. And you know it.
I know very few things.
You know things can be measured. You measure every day. You weigh and measure every day. You weigh and measure people. You weigh and measure leaders. You weigh and measure economies. You weigh and measure politics.
It's a very good.
You weigh and measure. You weigh.
Hang on.
Your whole life, in fact, is measuring.
So what you've now done is a great thing, is you've used the word measure, a mathematic term, in the common vernacular and abused it. So I don't even recognize what it means. It's so abusive to my field.
Why? And let's go to that. In mathematics, measure means what specifically?
There's no specific. It's an approximation or giving something a number.
We're not asking you to go to the ninth decimal point.
You didn't say that before.
No, you're not going to the ninth.
What if I say measure how tall are you? You'd say in your case 6 foot.
6 feet.
But is it 6 foot 1 inch?
Give or take, between 5'11 and 6 feet.
But what's that? So the question is, I want an accurate.
I got Zeno's paradox.
I don't even know what it means to measure you. Am I measuring the top of your hair, the top of your skull?
You're being rabbinical.
I shaved my beard off.
No, my point is, isn't that going through the Torah where you're parsing every definition? However we broadly define measure, your life literally is about measurement, is it not?
It's about putting numbers on things so that I can try my best. That you can call it whatever you like. If that makes you feel better.
I want to make you happy. Back to your scientific inquiry.
A number is a complicated
thing.
When
did you come to this aha moment? When it was in your solitary confinement, when the biggest financial crisis in world history was going on in your 7x9 jail cell with your metal bed and your two brushes because you were a trustee with the brown uniform on, trustee spelled wrong? Is that the moment of clarity that you had about science and Newtonian physics and everything that we can measure is really not going to be the way we go forward? It's going to be some much more esoteric, emotional intelligence thing. Was that your moment of clarity?
I wish it was, because it would make such a great story for this interview, but it's not. It's the fact that I lead such a privileged life to come across.
When did it happen, or did it happen before?
I'm in a privileged position to have some of the world's smartest people come to my house and tell me what they think about different subjects, and I finally realized that the thing that they had most in common was there was this area, no matter how smart they were, that when I asked them the questions, they said they'd have to resort to a 500 or 1,000-year-old response to that question, which was, I don't know.
You know who else found that out? Socrates. That's what Socrates kept doing, right? Socrates kept asking all the experts. He would go through, question after question after question, and realize at the end, they didn't really know. They really didn't basically understand what they were talking about.
And one of the things that people won't enjoy, it turns out that potentially one of the bad things to teach children is how to write. Writing, reading, and arithmetic was supposed to be, everyone's supposed to be taught. But writing forces you into a very narrow channel of thinking. You have to write in a certain form, in a certain way, in a certain linear pattern. So your thinking becomes somewhat narrow. The reason I brought up writing is one of the recent discoveries of mine with respect to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle is they never wrote anything. They spoke, and people around who could write wrote. Socrates could think. So that was...
Jesus of Nazareth was the same way, right? Never wrote anything.
I thought he was a carpenter.
He was a carpenter.
But didn't he need like a little carpenter's tool? No, I don't get that.
But at least his written record. Right. One last thing.
Sure. Thank you for having me to your house. Vegetable juice.
Was there any one aha moment in all these great thinkers? Did it happen before 2008? Was it after? That came up over, I know, many years, but when did you actually realize, hey, new's got to be developed?
Yeah, that's great. Is that I'm privileged enough to have people around me who've given lots of philanthropic gifts to institutions of higher learning. And when I said, the impact, how do you judge the impact of your giving? And we sat down and said, No really new ideas have come out. And I realized that, of course, it hasn't come out because we've been looking at using science and mathematics, and it's the wrong tool. It's obvious.
Institutions that are set up and try to put forward knowledge and understanding and truth, should they take your money?
Derek Bach at Harvard said, taking money for good causes is a good thing.
So if Hitler took all the gold out of the teeth of the Jews and said, I want to give this to Heidelberg University to fund the Leibniz chairs so that I can study high-energy physics, Derek Bach would say that was fine?
Again, it's these questions are questions where good people on both sides, like your Charlottesville, could differ. I don't know the answer to
this question. So tell us the two. Give us the two answers. The one answer why it shouldn't be, and then the one answer. Derek Bach says, I'll take essentially take cash from anybody because I got so many projects, so many good guys, and this is the way I'll do it. So I'm indifferent to where the cash comes from. Money's money. And if I got good guys, I'm the fiduciary that says these are good people and this is good research, okay, I'll take the cash from however, from any source, including you. What's the other argument?
Let me give you that. I know in my case,
Your money dirty money?
If you live.
Just ask a question. Is your money dirty money?
No, it's not. So, in fact...
Why is it not dirty money?
Because I earned it.
But you earned it...
I earned it legally.
We went back to this before. You earned it advising the worst people in the world, right, that do enormous bad things, and just to make more money.
So... instead of asking me the question, should you take the money? Because I think it's a legitimate question.
You think it's a legitimate question?
Yes, no
Why?
Question. Because I think you have to, ethics is always a complicated subject. But I can tell you that with the money I gave to help try to eradicate polio in Pakistan and India, instead of asking me whether that money should be given to these children for vaccines, I think you might want to ask their mothers who received the vaccine, who know their child now won't get polio, and ask them if Epstein should have helped these people with their money.
You're a mathematician. If we walked into that clinic where they're giving that money out to these people that are in the most dire straits of poverty and sickness and told them that the money was coming from class 3 sexual predator?
Tier one.
What's tier? Tier one's the highest and worst.
No, I'm the lowest.
You're the lowest. Okay, tier one. You're the lowest. But a criminal.
Yes.
That the money came from them. What percentage of people do you estimate? I understand you don't like probabilities. Do you estimate would say, I don't care. I want the money for my children.
I would say everyone said I want the money for my children.
Did they know where the money came from?
I think if I told them, the devil himself. The devil himself said, I'm going to exchange some dollars for your child's life.
Do you think you're the devil himself?
No, but I do have a good mirror.
It's a serious question. Do you think you're the devil himself?
I don't know. Why would you say that?
Because you have all the attributes. You're incredibly smart. You remember, the devil is somebody
who
knows
what?
The devil's brilliant. You read Milton's Paradise Lost.
The devil scares me.
Satan is at the number one or two archangel, and the reason he goes to hell and leads the rebellion is because he can't be the top guy. Hmm. And his thing is, I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven.
I saw that in a movie once called American Dharma. I don't remember who said it. Okay, we have to go.
Okay, good.